You're listening to The Record on KUOW. I'm Bill Radke. Were you one of the 29 million Americans that tuned into the royal wedding over the weekend? Even if you didn't watch, you may have heard a bit.
So darling, darling, stand by me.
That's a Church of England wedding. That's Karen Gibson in the Kingdom Choir at the wedding of Prince Harry and American actress Meghan Markle, now the Duke and Duchess of Sussex. And here to discuss the wedding and some of the weekend's other happenings, Leah Baltus, editor-in-chief of City Arts Magazine, and John Roderick, singer, guitarist with the band The Long Winters. Hi, folks.
Hello.
Hello.
Thanks for coming in. So nearly 1 in 10 Americans watched the royal wedding, including, I understand, Leah Baltus. Why did you care enough to DVR a stranger's wedding?
Well, I have to confess that I did go to college with Meghan Markle. I did not know her, but it did pique my interest just enough to DVR it and watch it on fast forward.
And what did you find? What was the most surprising thing about watching the wedding?
I mean, it was really moving. I thought they did an amazing job planning the whole thing out to make it seem really intentional, and to have the, you know, big deal of Meghan joining the royal family actually pay off in ways that seemed meaningful and like they might have some kind of impact, or at least be some kind of a tonic in the dystopia that we're living in.
Favorite moment? One moment?
Probably that choir performance you just played, the Stand By Me.
John Roderick, are you a royal watcher, a royal don't carer? You are a royal, by the way. Last time we talked about you being the king of the seafarer.
That's right. I'm Seattle royalty, seafarer king, presently, still part of my, I'm in my waning days of my tenure.
Where's your crown?
I don't wear it, but I do. I am wearing crown motif underwear.
Okay, so a lame duck King Neptune. What did you make of the wedding?
I am a royal fan. I'm an Anglophile. I watch the Queen. But I didn't watch the wedding because I guess it just seemed like a wedding. But I did read about it on the blogs. I got the wedding filtered by other people's opinion. So I, you know, obviously, like in today's world, you can't not have an opinion. But I agree. I think it was it appeared to be a lovely ceremony, and it seems like a watershed moment.
Couple of things so many people are talking about, how black the wedding was, biracial bride, black gospel choir, black cello soloist, Oprah Winfrey, Idris Elba, and the sermon from Bishop Michael Curry, the first black head of the U.S. Episcopal Church.
When love is the way, there's plenty good room. Plenty good room for all of God's children. Because when love is the way, we actually treat each other, well, like we are actually family.
Not just saying we're family. What if we treated each other like we're actually family? I got a whiff from the blogs that the royal family was reacting to his sermon. They were
surprised, delighted,
agape. I'm not sure.
Amazed. Yeah, watching
the
faces of the immediate family was definitely amusing. Although they didn't seem to be, on the verge of giggles in a dismissive or condescending way. More just like the shock, maybe, of having been so mired in the usual stuffiness for so long that they couldn't believe what was happening.
Yes, that's a good way to put it. I have to point out, the New York Times called it a hugely symbolic moment with the potential to change the world's view of the royal family and perhaps Britain's view of itself. On the other hand, the black English sociologist Kehinde Andrews said, we're getting distracted from real issues of British racism. Quote, Meghan Markle is not a dark-skinned, afro-haired, flat-nosed black woman. She represents the image of blackness we've been sold as acceptable and marketable. The best hope is the nation forgets about Markle's blackness and she blends in, effectively passing for white. The worst-case scenario is that Markle comes to represent a symbol for racial progress in Britain, which obviously that professor thinks she is not.
Right. I mean, the royal family, although generations or two back, represent imperialism in every sense of the word, the current generation has always seemed to me to be both very progressive politically and also, I mean, Charles and Diana have done work in this realm long before their kids were born, right? They were not, you don't go back and find any transcripts of Charles or Diana being exclusionary. And Charles has worked really hard his whole life. So I get the sense of the royal family as being a lot further along than you might think, given that they are like this very symbol of tradition. You know, and the England abolished slavery first, right? So they do have a legacy. I mean, obviously, racism in England now is as much a problem as it is here. And anti-immigrant sentiment, like that's pervasive in Europe as well. But I think this is I think they're more progressive than we give them credit for.
I mean, they let this all happen, right? The Queen approved the plan.
Yeah,
right?
Embraced it even.
And Meghan didn't just take the path of least resistance, it would appear. The Duchess of Sussex made a lot of choices to really assert her heritage in a way that seemed strong-willed.
And her husband was at her side through it all.
And what about, Leah, what about the idea of this being a feminist wedding? Did it come off that way when you DVR'd it?
I mean, I think it's kind of a big deal for anyone who has anything resembling a traditional wedding to decide exactly how you're coming down the aisle. And the fact that she entered the church alone was a pretty strong statement. And obviously her fingerprints were all over it, which showed her agency in the midst of a lot of powerful folks. So in that sense, I thought it was pretty feminist.
All right. Well, I just couldn't believe it was a Givenchy dress. I mean, I was thinking Sarah Burton, maybe a designer.
But the designer is British.
Yes.
Well, and also, I love that you guys know how to pronounce it. I was like, Givenchy.
$45 million wedding. And wow. My wife and I pulled off a wedding for half that. So it just seems extravagant. And Anthony Bourdain, by the way, said, I'm all for love, but if you're attending the royal wedding, I kind of automatically don't like you. And that set off a whole, you know, what do you think of people who care or don't care?
Well, and that's the other thing, right? I mean, class was traditionally the conversation that we had around a royal wedding.
Yeah.
It was a very different conversation that we're having about this wedding, and that also feels like a progression.
I want to talk about a couple of other things. One, a disaster that happened over the weekend. We were just discussing earlier in the show these two mountain bikers attacked by a cougar near North Bend, and one of them was killed, and I was asking this conservation ecologist, you know, what should you do? And this guy is working hard to reintroduce grizzly bears to the North Cascade. So one of his big messages is, you know, well, here's what you should do. And one death is a disaster, and it's one too many. On the other hand, we're not trying to remove all the danger from nature. How did you react to the? It's a very rare attack. To have even a cougar attack is rare, much less a fatal one.
It is, although I know a man who's been attacked by a cougar in Montana. He was jogging on a logging trail, and a cougar was high up above him on a kind of a cut, and jumped on his back. And he was a guy from Butte, Montana, so he and the lion fought one another to a standstill. So he was shredded, but he recognized that what you don't let a mountain lion do, the mountain lion is going to try and roll on its back and get you on top of it, and then it'll eviscerate you.
So it's got the four claws?
Well, and its hind claws are where its strength is, and it'll take your guts out. Right. So he didn't let it do that, and he fought this thing off. The cougar got his backpack off, and after they were facing one another in a standoff, the cougar went over and peed on his backpack and then disappeared into the forest.
Leah, does that, the presence of that kind of danger, however rare, does that affect whether you're out in the mountains in the foothills or not?
I'm an avoider of wilderness.
Yeah?
Yeah, I have Lyme disease. It hasn't treated me well.
No, that's awful.
Right. So, yeah, I mean, it's funny, though. I was actually just reading this Urban Bestiary book like 2 weeks ago by a local author, and she writes about how rare it is for cougars to attack and raccoons, and I was feeling all better, you know? And then this headline came out this weekend. So sad, of course. And, you know, you got to feel terribly for the families of these people. But at the same time, like, is it because they were on bikes and they were looking quadrupedal and so they seemed more like a typical prey? Is it because the cougar was so emaciated? Is it because, who knows? But beware.
Yes, you can go online here pretty soon and listen to the best advice and thoughts of this conservation ecologist, Chris Morgan. Well, how did you get Lyme disease?
I went to the forest near the Wenatchee River, just east or west of Leavenworth, and was bitten by a bad, bad tick.
How are you doing?
I'm fine. It's been like 10 years. I'm pretty functional, but it's not an enjoyable process. So, you know, DEET.
Yes.
Some of this
yes.
stuff is a reminder that we, you know, what we love about living in the Northwest is our proximity to nature and the wilderness. But that has responsibilities. And we tend to think because we've built freeways that we've domesticated the wild, but we haven't. And if you want to go to these places, you wear a bell and you're conscious of the fact that it's not your turf. This turf belongs to the wild.
Yeah. Wear a bell, make a lot of noise, don't run.
Put your hands up in the air and make yourself big.
One more thing over the weekend. I saw researchers at UC Irvine. They concluded that songs are getting sadder, at least in the UK. They looked at the top 100 singles. I don't know why just the UK, between 1985 and July 2015. And they concluded that the public prefers happier songs, but more and more unhappy songs are being released every year. In other words,
I hate to turn up out of the blue uninvited, but I couldn't stay away. I couldn't fight it. I had hoped you'd see my face and that you'd be reminded that for me it isn't over. Never mind, I'll find someone like you.
John Roderick, you're blurry through my tears. You are a musician. What do you have to say about unhappy songs?
I'm a musician and I write almost exclusively unhappy songs.
Why?
I think that they're at a certain point, as pop has evolved, it's become more and more emotional, more and more acceptable to express, the tracks of my tears style emotion rather than get up, stand up, or, you know, like party music.
Mm-hmm.
And also, you know, as R&B has evolved to become a big part of our popular culture, I mean, that all comes from church music, and a lot of that is very impassioned, personal music. And I think just culturally, we talk a lot more about our emotions than my father or even my, you know, older brothers' generations did.
Yeah.
It's just part of the way we interact with each other now. We are much more candid about how we feel.
Drake seems like a modern rapper. you brought us a favorite sad song, Leah. This is Morphine's In Spite of Me.
Last night I told a stranger all about you. Smiled patiently with disbelief. I always knew you would succeed no matter what you tried, and I know you did it all in spite of me.
Are you drawn to the sad songs too?
Oh, yeah. I love feel bad TV. I love, you know, get the emotions out. I like to sing along. I've been known to listen to that song for at least 4 hours on end on repeat, you know.
If you listen to the recording of that, even, you hear a plosive on the microphone at one point. It's very raw recording. And that's not a thing that we would have ever let through in the 70s or 80s.
Right.
So we've lost polish, but in favor of intimacy.
Well, there you go. Songs, even upbeat. I mean, the beats are, a lot of it is dance music, but these researchers concluding that the lyrical content is getting unhappier and unhappier. For me, it's Can't Stop the Feeling by Justin Timberlake. It makes me despondent.
What, you like rock and roll? You like happy songs?
I'll do a little of both. You know, I love the John Prine song, Sam Stone. There's a hole in daddy's arm where the money goes. Jesus Christ died for nothing, I suppose. You don't get lower than that.
That's pretty hard.
But if you're going hard with the low, then yeah, absolutely. Bring it on. We've been talking with our guests and weekend watchers, John Roderick, singer, guitarist with the band The Long Winters, Leah Baltus, editor-in-chief of City Arts Magazine. Let's come back and recap another weekend.
Yeah.
Sounds good.
Thanks, guys.
I got this feeling.
Oh, it makes me cry.
Inside my bones. It goes electric, wavy when I turn it on. Off from my city, off from my home. We're flying up, no ceiling when we in our zone. I got that sunshine in my...